John Daly here. You know what day it is?
Neither do I.
I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto. America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Well, watching Philippe Clement's Norwich City on the road in 2026 has been almightily impressive. An eighth win from 10 away games at Bristol City. A comeback win as well, the second consecutive one after that brilliant victory at Millwall. And it was a rather impressive afternoon in the West Country. Welcome to this week's edition of the Pinken.com Norwich City podcast to reflect on another Mo Torre hat-trick, as well as all the shenanigans that went down at Ashton Gate on Saturday afternoon. I'm Connor Southwell, joined by Paddy Davitt. No Adam Harvey this week. He is, I think, as we speak, either en route to Portugal or in Portugal, which is a far nicer location than either of us, as beautiful as the fine city is. So, us two as a front two this week to hopefully bring you at least a level of insight and analysis of what unfolded yesterday. Paddy, it was in the round, a really, really good win. I think there are elements of the first half that I want to speak about in the probably wider context of looking forwards. But as a result and as an afternoon for those, just over 2,000, I think it was 2,033 travelling Norwich City supporters yesterday, that long journey home would have been a really sweet one given what they saw unfold yesterday.
And following on from Derby disappointment, absolutely. It was the perfect response for those supporters. Adam's not here, but we'll give him a hat tip. When we did our Instagram show Saturday morning from our sprawling Cotswolds base, he was far more closer to the mark than either me or you. I thought we might be an end of season syndrome and it might play out to be a score draw. And he was bold. He said 3-2 Norwich. So he wasn't far off. Certainly got the right amount of goals, didn't he? I think he started 2-1 for Norwich. So definitely I was bringing up the rear there. But and more importantly, those four goals for Norwich all at the away end. And what a great second half that must have been to be part of that and to be, in there. I've seen some nice socials since, how much those supporters enjoyed that. And it really sells a lie to me and anybody else who thought wrongly that that's it, done and dusted now. Millwall, Easter Monday and all that entailed, and then Derby and all that entailed. It's now just going to be playing out time, playing out games. You might have said that was looking to be the case at half-time, to follow on from your point about that first half, Connor, but absolutely no doubt about it. They were scintillating, really. And it's Roy Hodgson, who, there's a guy who's achieved everything in the game in terms of his managerial profession, right up and including England. And he was very magnanimous and said we could learn from Norwich. They taught us a lesson in terms of the finishing, in terms of how clinical it was. And I think for me, that is nail on head, because Bristol had a lot of opportunities in that first half, didn't take them beyond the Sam Morsy opener. And when Norwich did get chances in that second half, particularly in that spell, 25, 30 minutes or so, they were absolutely ruthless. And some real good team goals as well. And of course, it helps when you've got a finisher as hungry and insatiable as Mo Torre is. And we'll get into him in due course. But it really is a testament to Clement, who clearly, was slightly remote in terms of wasn't able to be on the touchline, but nevertheless was in and around the group. And as Ryan Gary, who did the media after the game, said, he was there at half-time as well in the away dressing room. But Philippe, his coaching staff and those players, that you get to half-time off the back of that Derby disappointment, you're 1-0 down, you haven't really played well. More than easy to maybe just turn it in, and they did the opposite. They actually stepped forward, grabbed that game. And it was telling. I watched the highlights back earlier today, actually, and I didn't realise in real time. But if you go and look at when Torres scores that opener to equalise, 51 minutes on the clock, there was no celebrations with the away end. It was literally grab that ball out the net, get back to the centre circle, we're winning this game. And I think that was pretty revealing as well, that they wasn't happy just to be back on level terms. It was, we go forward, we go on. And I think I'm right saying, five away league wins out of the last six is, you know, traditionally how difficult it is to go away from home. Mm. And Norwich, for many a season, have struggled at that. Not at the moment. They look a real serious outfit. And, okay, you know, Bristol maybe let them back into the game. But you have to be good enough and clinical enough to accept that opportunity. And boy, did they do that. So, yeah, those fans, us fortunate to be there. Anybody watching from afar. That was a real uplifting afternoon, I think, because it underlines that how demanding Philippe Clement is and how he will not let them get away with anything at any point of the season. And that bodes really well, that winning culture and that ruthlessness for what we hope is, you know, a very full-on assault on promotion next season. So, yeah, nothing but positives, I think, bearing in mind, you know, where they were certainly at half-time at Ashton Gate.
Yeah, you made the point, and when I was speaking to our Radio Norfolk colleague Chris Gorham yesterday, he made the point as well, that acts of, you know, picking the ball out of the net, running to the halfway line. If there's anyone maybe out there who is feeling that Norwich are happy to let this season peter out, or maybe on the beach, or maybe aren't that hungry or enthusiastic from here on in after that disappointment last week, that was a really nice bit of symbolism that perhaps they were, particularly after what was a pretty tired first half, as we all come on to. But it's pretty remarkable, Paddy, what they're doing on the road. As you said there, I think notoriously you think about the Championship as being a league, and it even has kind of its own cliche, doesn't it? And maybe football generally, in terms of if you can win your home games and draw away from home, then you're not going to end up in too bad a position. And that will get you to kind of the 2 points per game mark that is kind of historically used as the benchmark for any promotion campaign. But you look at what Norwich are doing there. I mean, since Philippe Clement's arrival at the club in November, no team has taken more points on the road than Norwich, 26 in 14 games. They've scored 26 in that time. Only Southampton, who've been on a really resurgent run of form under Tonda Eckhart and trying to crash into the top two of the Championship, have scored more with 30, and they've conceded just 16, and that is bettered only by Alex Neil's Millwall, and his name is pertinent for the reasons that I mentioned, because that record of 8 wins in 10 away from home, it's only the second time in Norwich City's history that they've achieved that, and the other time was during that run that Alex Neil, after he took over and eventually took them obviously to the playoffs and at Wembley to win there. Absolutely remarkable. Fourth in the away table. We can talk a lot about what maybe they aren't doing at Carrow Road, but what they are doing on the road is mightily impressive. And again, some stats to litter in from NCFC numbers. First time that Norwich have won consecutive away games after falling behind since November 2005. That was against Nigel Worthington's. That was under Nigel Worthington. That was games against Crewe and Sheffield United. And it's also the first after trailing at halftime since that Ashton Gate game in December 2023, when Adam Eder effectively saved David Wagner's job, didn't he? And Wagner was on the pitch that day. So in terms of being travellers, and this is where I think there is a broader conversation to be had about the way Norwich play and the style that they're playing. We can link this maybe a little bit to the first half. Are they a team, Paddy, that the way they play under Clement, with the intensity, with the way they want to press, but also how opponents sit up against them? They're naturally, teams are more expansive at home. There's an expectation that you try and play a little bit more. Is that enabling or leaning into the way that Norwich City want to play under Philippe Clement?
Well, you have to say it is, Connor, because as you're talking there, I'm just thinking the similarities between the second goal yesterday, which was that lovely flowing team move, and the winner at Millwall, which was, you know, basically Jack Stacey, I think, sparking that from a turnover situation in Norwich's defensive third. We'll go back to that team goal yesterday. It was Jose Cordoba breaking up a ball that had come into the box up the end of a Bristol counter. And McLean, Mahoma, Schwartau, lovely precision, perfect timing on the passes. The awareness from Schwartau to just square that across, draw Vitek, take him out of the equation, Motore, in you go, walk that ball into the net. So there you have it, just the last two away wins, very similarly constructed goals, one end of the pitch to the other, while that other team are the front foot protagonists. And I think those stats, that couple of examples I've thrown in there, do probably underline that away from home, this team perfectly set up under Philippe Clement. The challenge, and we said that, we discussed that towards the end of this first half yesterday, because it felt very similar to the first half against Ipswich the week before at Carrow Road. Fell behind early, two teams who then retreated, two blanks of four. Okay, Norwich, you have the ball. You can have a bit of territory. Break us down. And in both examples, you know, Norwich were not able to and didn't really look like they had the necessary guile, be it individually or collectively, to sort of try and penetrate that. So then you start to think, well, okay, moving it forward, opening it up, if that's going to be the challenge that maybe is more difficult for a Clermont side to deal with, then they're going to have to try and, you know, reinvent themselves to a degree. I thought it was interesting at halftime yesterday that Ryan Gary said that for him, the trigger, and Clermont as well, was that they just had to up the intensity. Talked a little bit about Torre's movement had to be better. It had to be a bit more in behind and across the back line because it felt all a little bit static and a little bit predictable, not just him, but Norwich as a collective. And there's no doubt that was a transforming second half in terms of the style of play in the game. And I suppose scoring so early as they did, you know, as we said, 51 minutes on the clock, then that by definition opens it up. Then Bristol have to come out, commit a few more bodies forward. That little plays into Norwich's hands. We saw the second goal. We saw the third goal. The amount of space that Norwich had for the majority of that second half. And it is the cliche, but nevertheless, it is true. Goals do change games. And there's no doubt if Norwich had managed to get a goal maybe against Ipswich in that first half and likewise against Bristol, then it becomes a different game. It probably becomes a little bit more of a basketball style game, and that on the growing body of evidence would seem to suit a Philippe Clermont set up side. Now, I think the reality is teams will look at how Ipswich went about it, and maybe Bristol and Roy looked at that, and that's why they were, once they got the early goal, were very happy to adopt similar approach, out of possession, obdurate, try and break us down. I think more often than not, that's going to be the challenge, certainly at Carr Road next season. And Norwich will need to counteract that because, you know, we've seen a few occasions really where it has been a bit more hard work, a bit more of a grind. It hasn't been that free-flowing, almost off-the-cuff, effervescent attacking licence and verve that we see on the road. And that's something I'm sure, I've no doubt, Clermont, how forensic he goes into these things, he will be as his coaching staff, and they'll have to maybe, partly might be what they look to do in the summer window, but also with this current group of players, they're going to have to certainly have a bit more of a nuanced approach, I think, between when they go away from home, where they look so full of goals and attacking threat, and maybe at Carr Road, when the respect that teams will show, if they see what Norwich are doing and have done under Clermont, they will come and they will deem maybe a point a good result and get back on the coach without too much damage. And, you know, we saw that in the Farker era, but the difference being, you know, the Farker style was possession, was manoeuvring players around, it was patience. You had magicians like Buendia in the mix as well. And they were able, even when teams came with that philosophy, able to, you more often than not, certainly in those two title winning seasons, find the answers. And, you know, I guess you look at a player like Mahoma, and I'm not for a minute drawing a parallel right now in terms of him and Buendia, but he sees pictures. He can operate in pockets of space. Slimani can likewise. Do those type of players and anybody else who comes in the summer, do they become exponentially more important in a Carr Road setting than maybe on the road, where it'll be maybe more a little bit about pace in wide areas and transitional moments and counters? And you know, you see the power that Schwartau has when he opens his legs, and Ali Ahmed can do that. Papa Diallo, we've seen, albeit around his injury problems, can do that. I think we're probably of the opinion they'll look to maybe add similar profiles, a wide player in the summer. So you can see how that almost twin track approach could be how we go now and how Clermont goes, because you know the reality is there's few secrets in the Championship, and you need a degree of reinvention. You need different profiles of player, because once you feel you've cracked it, and obviously my team, Coventry, you know, yesterday they've got there, but there was a very, very sticky spell, and Norwich were one of the teams who got the better of them around the turn of the year, when maybe teams had started to work them out a little bit and were a little bit difficult, more difficult to break down. And again, you know, that was a reflection of where Coventry were going and running away with the league at that point. And they had to come through that. And maybe Frank Lampard would sort of talk around how they had to reinvent themselves to a degree and maybe go back and look at things and tweak things and nuance things. And yeah, Norwich will have to go on the same journey, because, you know, you get nothing easy in this division. And what Norwich are doing now, you can be sure the effect of that is rippling around this league, and teams are now well aware of Clermont, what he wants to do, what he's trying to do with this group of players. And obviously, you know, as a result, anybody they come up against now will be doing everything they can to try and nullify that and take away some of the strengths of this Clermont setup.
Yeah, and there's always different phases, isn't there, under managers? And I think we saw this a little bit under Johannes Hoftorp. You have that initial phase where there's an element of what they're trying to do, and you see that, and maybe there's not that understanding from other coaches, or there's that kind of wait and see element from other coaches. And then you have what I would kind of describe as phase two, which is then when teams begin to maybe realise those strengths and weaknesses and how to counteract. And it felt yesterday very much like Roy Hodgson. And to be fair, you look at his career and what a career he's had, 5 decades of coaching at the very highest level, some unbelievable teams on his CV. Obviously now 79 and still coaching, which I think is a sign of, you know, his longevity to be able to come back in and have the impact that he's had at Bristol City. That has been built on defensive organisation. You give team an early goal, and it did feel like Bristol City were, to an extent, copying the Ipswich copybook, putting their two really organised and really set banks of four, and they're in a 4-4-2 shape out of possession. They condensed the space. They made it very limited. And when you've got a Mo Touré, as we saw probably in the second half, what he wants and probably what he needs as well for his game to flourish is space behind, to get that pace and to really stretch it, as, to be fair, Oscar Schwartau as well, who's such a powerful runner, as we saw. And I think that there's so much that Norwich have improved at under Philippe Clermont. Their pressing, I think, by and large now is excellent. The counter-pressing as well, the way they build up from deep areas, I think is really good. They attack on transition, as we've spoken about, and as we've seen those examples that you gave, so dangerous. But I think when they've kind of struggled the most is when they've been a team that is dominant and they've had maybe a lot of the ball. I think you could even, I recognise maybe it's a little bit harsh to do this because I think they had better opportunities, but even Southampton away, where they had that second half where they'd really pinned Southampton in, the actual ability to convert that into really clear-cut chances were few and far between. And that is, as you map out correctly, I think, a game situation that if they are to continue on this trajectory, they're going to face a lot more of. And I think it also speaks as to what I said earlier, why there has been maybe this slight difference between why they've been so successful away from home compared to at Carrow Road, where, and that's not to say they've had a bad record at Carrow Road. They, of course, did under Manning. And if you look over the season, I think it's their most home defeats in 70-odd years. But actually, that's skewed slightly by what was a terrible start. Under Clermont, it's been okay, but it's not been to the kind of levels that it has been away from home, where a lot of the heavy lifting has been done. And I actually think kind of moving forward to this, it feels like someone like Jovan Mokoama, with his physicality, or another striker, maybe if they go into the market to add another, will be really important for how they want to play, because they have that physicality and that ability to link, coupled with, like you say, and I agree, adding quality. That feels like what it's going to be about in those kind of in the summer, lifting the ceiling of some of those players. So they've got just different options. I think they lack a little bit of pace at times, certainly 1v1 kind of players in those wider areas. Ali Ahmed has, for me, been really good at kind of getting in those half spaces and slipping balls in behind. That feels like kind of his strength, but maybe someone who able is actually quite a good dribbler, actually quite a good crosser, set piece taker, would be nice to add into that as well, just to give them different tools to break down teams. And I think it's fair to mention, Paddy, and it is, of course, you have to contextualise this with the league, but it's something that Clermont was kind of not criticised for, but it was a comment made, I think, when we had the chaps from the Rangers Review on, speaking about Clermont. They spoke about this. These teams are transitional. They set up better against maybe teams that are perceived to be better, i.e. European competitions, as opposed to maybe in those league games where Rangers were having 60, 70% of the possession, having to convert that into chances. But I think, again, you have to contextualise that as maybe not being a Clermont issue and being more of a Scotland issue when you manage up there. But that feels to me, and I don't know what you think, Pat, but probably the one question mark I have around this team as we begin to look to next season, which is what it's about from here. And like you say, maybe some of that is naturally fixed by the work they do in the window and their recruitment. But I think it all adds to that sense that if they can polish that bit, if they can get that bit, I see a pretty strong team in kind of all facets of the game, maybe with some tidying up defensively as well, which is a nice place to be in. And maybe slightly unrealistic to think that Philippe Clermont could crack all of these issues in his first kind of 8 months, with pretty much, barring a couple of January additions, the same squad that he inherited.
Yeah, and as you're talking there, and I think fullbacks, that's a key area as well. I don't think and they have each of their own individual abilities, you know. But and obviously injury and has been an issue there in terms of the left-hand side, particularly in, you know, that continues with Ben Crezene scheduled to see a specialist on Monday. Would seem that's season-ending shoulder surgery. Mahovo hopefully comes back in, but he's had a terrible run in terms of unavailability. And for those reasons, I don't think in the fullback areas they've necessarily maybe shown for me, you draw the obvious parallel as I'm talking is the Jamal Lewis, Max Aarons, you know, in terms of the width and the natural attacking instincts to create those overloads in wide areas, which pulls teams who are in those blocks and those banks of four a little bit out of their comfort zone. And of course, then you're getting around the sides, and that's, you know, to your point there about Mukama and Torre, then maybe that's the type of service they would feast on as well if you're pulling balls in back from the byline. So I think that's part of the equation as well. And, you know, he just hasn't had a run really where he's maybe able to put his hat on two fullbacks. These are the two. I can work with these two now in terms of counteracting maybe that Carrow Road element of well-set defensive lines and how maybe the fullback areas could be areas of, you know, some promise to counteract that. So, again, you know, it feels like, and we're not talking from any sense of inside knowledge, but it feels like a Harry Amass type of addition would be one that it would look to do again this summer. And, you know, by all accounts, we didn't see, sadly, in a Norwich shirt, but he is one of those who's very attacking, naturally athletic, powerful, dynamic fullbacks that you see in the modern game now. And they're so important. You know, you look at the best sides and those areas of the pitch can sometimes decide these tight contests. And, you know, Kellen Fisher would need to add those elements to his game, but I think he's certainly good enough technically to be worked on in that regard. You know, maybe there's a feeling with Jack Stacey, I think probably maybe the wheel has turned now, and in terms of moving it forward and looking into the mid to longer term, I'm not sure necessarily your answer there is Jack Stacey. Clearly a player who, if he was in and around the squad, you know, would be more than a useful asset. But I just think now moving forward, you know, if you've got Fisher, Crezene, Mahovo, but both of those, sadly, and until further notice, will have those asterisks around their fitness and their reliability and their durability. So you add another player maybe, and then, you know, you look then, and they look defensively very well set with Cordoba, McConville, even Darling now is upturned in terms of his form. So, yeah, I think all of those elements you talked about further forward, agree. But equally, I think those fullback areas within this debate about how do they push through maybe some issues that are starting to feel a residual at Carr Road. You know, I was really trying to think. I mean, you might throw one in here, Connor, but I'm struggling to think of it where they've been quite as dominant as they were second half yesterday. Millwall for the majority. All those links in those away game chains. When have we seen that at Carrow where they've really put teams to the sword? I'm thinking back, you know, Blackburn, that was a nutritional win. Birmingham, they obviously lost that game, the derby. And, you know, I'm sure there's one or two, but it feels a lot harder to reach back into the memory and pick out a Clermont Carrow Road masterclass in terms of clinical, in terms of goal-scoring threat, in terms of ruthlessness, when away from home, you can pick any number of examples on his watch. So, yeah, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, within the context of, you know, it's a lot easier for me to sort it this way around than you're strong at home, you can't pick up a point away from home, because you clearly need strong away form to supplement your home form if you're going to be a contender for promotion. So, They're a long way down the path, and it's only natural because he's had a matter of months and one transfer window and all these injuries to contend with, that he hasn't cracked maybe the whole part of the equation. But I've no doubt, as good a coach as he is, he will be coming up with some solutions to what could be, certainly next season, if they continue in this vein, a problem they have to face more often than not at Carrow Road.
Yeah, agreed. And like we said, I think injuries play a part as well. And you mapped out the fullback situation. I mean, he's effectively not had a fit left back for a real consistent period of that. I agree with what you said on the right. And even as good as Kellen Fisher has been, I think we both agree quite comfortably Norwich's best choice at right back. I still think attacking wise, and I think he's been the first to admit this as well when he's spoken about it, there are elements there that he needs to add. Obviously, Liam Gibbs on the left, I think, was interesting. They did some kind of quite funky stuff with him in possession yesterday in terms of inverting him and all of that stuff, which was quite interesting to see. But I agree. And I think I would also, Pelle Mats has been outstanding for Norwich, particularly since Philippe Clement come in. Kenny McLean, outstanding for Norwich. But again, creatively, do they give you enough in that area? I think particularly Mattson, obviously McLean drops a little bit deeper, so he's more of the supplier. I think I'd like to see a little bit more from Mattson in terms of unlocking doors and being a bit more buzzy in the final third. And I know people will say, oh, well, he scored, what, 3 goals in his last 4 games or whatever, but they've been really good strikes from the edge of the box. I'd like to see some unlocking of doors, some assists, some him joining in the attacking phase a little bit more, purely because I think he's got the ability to do it. And it would then help ease the load on some of those guys a little bit further forward. But yeah, like you say, some of this is solved naturally through recruitment. Some of this, I think, will be solved in pre-season. And equally, I think what you would say, particularly given where they were and the way that probably a lot of the work Clement has done, has probably been about being transitional, because if they were going to be in a relegation battle, they were going to face teams that would fancy themselves against Norwich, that would be more dominant, that would want to have more of the ball. And it's probably, as a result, a victim of their own success that now they're facing something that maybe they haven't quite been able to work on as much. So it is just a minor sort of question mark, but there's kind of 3 halves of football. I think there's other evidence as well. Portsmouth on Good Friday, I think, is another example at Carrow Road. Southampton, as we mentioned, where they've really penned teams in, and we're seeing that pretty consistently now, where they're having spells of really good dominance and pressure in terms of territory, and it's maybe now just about converting that into chances. I mean, for example, the 3 halves, Ipswich, or the entirety of that game in the first half against Bristol City, they amassed a lower expected goals rate, so lower quality of chances for those 3 halves than they did in the second half alone at Ashton Gate. So that kind of shows, I think, the difference. And the key difference was, yes, their intensity and all those kind of base marks, but it was also that they scored an equaliser, and some of this, as ever, is kind of game state related. They managed to break that Bristol City shape. They created more space for themselves, and that's when they were able then to punish them with what was, yeah, a really good... Well, second goal in particular, I thought was really impressive. The speed of their transition, the way they transitioned as well. And that's probably a nice transition of our own into Mo Touré, who just cannot stop scoring goals, Paddy. It's funny, isn't it? You know, we've had so much debate about Matthias Kristgoeren and what he would have given to have scored that third goal that Mo Touré scored. And maybe this is the saying, isn't it? It's better to be lucky than good sometimes, because it probably speaks a little bit to the form that Mo Touré is in. The fact that he can just stand there, a ball can hit his hip and it deflects into the back of the net. When you're in that groove as a striker, that's and everything you touch turns to goals. I'm sure all strikers have a spell like this. It's a pretty glorious place to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's 10 goal contributions in 8, I think, championship games. Which, you know, that's Sergeant Plus. That's almost Pookie levels of productivity. And I know it's a small sample, but, you know, for a player who's come in and was seen as a project player, as McCarmel was, to be fair, you know, until in both cases injury just halted their progress, less so for Mode and Jovan. But, you know, you just feel, wow, what more is to come from both of those? How much more can Clement unlock? Because, you know, they're both still very raw. They're still young, understandably. They're still inexperienced. But they're raw attributes. And there might be, to follow on from the previous debate, you know, there might be an element of unknown quantities around these players, and that won't last. You can be sure that the word will be starting to get out, and the teams will show these players more respect. They'll probably try and double up on them in many respects. So that's part of their learning journey, that you know, you'll become a marked man very quickly when you're producing the numbers that he is and Jovan Mukama was before. So right now, just enjoy it. And just Wylock is just insatiable for goals, and he's a striker, but not all strikers are that necessarily, certainly in the modern game. Now there's different types of striker. There's the ones who are more, you know, involved in the build-up play and maybe more about bringing others into play. He very much feels like, get that ball in the box. I want to hit the back of the net. I want to keep it in the back of the net. That's how I measure my worth to this team. That's what fires him. And and to have that asset in the box. And you know, it looks relatively routine yesterday. You know, he's slotted a rebound from his initial header, then he walks a ball into the net, and then, as you say, you know, his hip expertly definitely deflects that shot from Paris Mahoma to wrong foot Vitek. But these are only very routine, simple tap-ins or finishes because he's in the right areas. He's operating in and around. He's alive to opportunities that could present themselves. He has that ability that all the top strikers do, where there's almost a sixth sense that you can't maybe even coach that he knows there's an opportunity there. I'm going to get myself to the near post. I'm going to pull off, cleverly find some space, because he was unmarked for that header for the first goal. Mm. You know, that's not a surprise. That's just good movement. That's timing your runs. That's holding your runs. That's holding your positions. All those elements that I'm sure now the likes of Ryan Gary, we know, has been working with it one-to-one, but Philippe and the rest of the coaches, all you want now is that, and it would appear that he is this type of guy. You spoke to him, obviously, after the end of the game, that he's humble, that he's willing to learn, he's willing to keep on learning, he's willing to go back to the training ground now today, tomorrow, and work hard and know there's areas of his game he needs to improve, rather than feeling, right, well, this is me now, I'm set fair here, I'm going to rip up this league and then I'm probably going to get off the back of that and move to a higher league. And he's obviously got a World Cup as well, which could raise his profile further. But you're better qualified than me to talk about his character, because I've not spoken to him one-to-one. But he doesn't strike me as a character who will get carried away, who the feet will start to leave the ground. I think he's very much, this is going well, but there's reasons why I'm doing X, Y, and Z, and I need to continue doing that and then add other elements to my game. And if you're Philippe Clement and you have that level of raw material to work with, that must be such a, as a coach, such an enjoyable strategy to be able to work with a Mo Touré, to work with a Jovan Mikama and make them better and fulfil their potential, because the potential and the ceiling for those players, if they continue at this rate, then it won't be long. And as we know, strikers are the commodities that they are. Prolific season or two at championship level, you will then have, if Norwich haven't already got there, Premier League grade clubs coming knocking, and the price that they will have to play to part company with these players will be, you know, getting into the many, many tens of millions. And, you know, that's for the future. But in the here and now, as a body of work, 2 months into the building, 3 months into the building, it really couldn't have gone any better. Bar that, as I say, that injury he picked up against Sheffield Wednesday, which just held him. But in a roundabout way, that might have been, and given how dizzying that first period must have been when he's come in, you know, from Denmark, and he's pitched straight in because of the situation Norwich found themselves in. Then he starts hitting the back of the net like there's no tomorrow, gets all that attention on him. You know, it reverberates back to Australia and back to England again in terms of his profile being raised. Probably wasn't the worst scenario, just to pull him out the firing line, injury enforced nevertheless, but pull him out, sit, reflect, process what's happened to him in his life in a very short period of time, and then come back and reset. And I'm sure, you know, that period out has allowed him to have that reflection and readjust and understand, you know, what it is that he's gone through in this period in his life. And if he continues on this path, then, you know, there's going to be a lot more to come from him. But yeah, there's no doubt about it. It's and if we're honest, we all know the backstory in January. They get Casper Hu, they don't get Mo Touré. So, you know, what a sliding doors moment that could prove to be. And that's not a slight on Casper Hu, who I'm sure now, off the back of what he did in the Champions League, probably will get himself a move to a bigger league than the English Championship come this summer. But, you know, maybe for the type of player Clement needs, the type of profile he needs, maybe, and we know what the model is, it's try and develop young players in the here and now for Norwich's first team, but later down the track, there's that transfer element to it as well with their ceilings, their price ceilings. Maybe, you know, maybe that's turned out to be a very good miss that they couldn't get Hu and they've got Mo Touré, because, you know, as he evidenced again yesterday, that is a player with the right service will score prolifically at championship level. And, you know, the fact that he's only going to get better from here is quite a frightening prospect, I am sure, for championship defenders, but also I'm sure on the flip side for Norwich fans to see how good him and McCarmer and possibly another addition in the summer in that area of the pitch can be, because the sparks are going to fly there, because it's quite clear the way Clermont wants to play, it'll be one. And, you know, if you've got two or three really hot strikers, each pushing each other to new levels, then clearly that's only going to mean Norwich are a team to be feared. And you can see it already in terms of the amount of goals they're scoring in games, particularly away from home. That's probably a signal of what's to come with Clermont. And as he says all along, you know, he wants to win games, but he wants to entertain. And when you've got goal scorers in your side, like McCarmer, like Torre, then that's certainly going to be the case. And and what I like also as well is, and I don't know if you're going to come on to him, but you know, Oscar Schwartau and the relationship that he's building now, because Ryan Gary made the point yesterday, and he's right too. Yes, Mo, you know, I've waxed lyrical here for 5 minutes or so, and he will get all the plaudits because he scored the three goals, and that's what happens. But Oscar Schwartau's role in that, you know, Paris Mahoma's role in that, to give these players the they need around them to maximise what they can offer in the box, that's also a hat tip to Clermont and his coaching staff as well. So, you know, the strides you've talked about, Schwartau needed to add end product, be it assists, be it goals, he very much is doing that now. So, you know, long may it continue. Him, Mahoma, one or two other, you know, some of those younger attacking players as well. And if that's the case, then, you know, there's only one way this is going to go, and that's better, faster, quicker, stronger, and more goals. And an exciting ride in store. There's no doubt about it, because, you know, the final thing I'd say, it just popped into my head. There was one of the Bristol-based journalists yesterday, when I went back down inside the stadium, waiting Ryan Gary and waiting Roy Hodgson, and they were just saying, how good is Norwich's recruitment? Where do they find these strikers? And he drew a parallel that, you know, Bristol have struggled with goal scorers. I think they had Tommy Conway, didn't they, a few years ago, but who went on to Borough. But, you know, they seemingly have found it difficult to go to market to find these young, hungry, up-and-coming, powerful goal-scoring, you know, prospects. And there's Norwich, have got two in the building, and I wouldn't bet against them going out and finding the third one in the summer. So, you know, it also bleeds into the work of Lee Dunn, Ben Napa, their teams, supplemented now by, you know, the in-house data analytics they've got. I think that all bodes very well for this summer, striker-wise, but also more broadly recruitment-wise.
Yeah, and as you mapped out, recruiting a striker is one of the hardest ones to do, because the ones that are scoring goals and are kind of in the proven category, if you like, they're the ones that cost money, aren't they? And they're the ones that you don't really need to look at the underlying numbers to really unearth. It's those Torres and McCarmers where you maybe just spot something, you see something in the data or when you watch them that actually maybe if in a better team, if you supply them with a certain quality of chance, you can get goals out of them. That's really savvy, clever recruitment to do that. And yeah, the fact Norwich have done that with McCarmer and now Torre as well. And yeah, like I was thinking yesterday, like the pretty unique circumstances, how much had to happen for Mo Torre to become a Norwich City player. First and foremost, you had to have the saga that unfolded with a certain American striker. Then, of course, you have to have Kasper Hjorg going on the goal-scoring run in the Champions League that he did, because if not, he becomes a Norwich City player. Like that's a pretty long list of events that needed to happen and needed to happen in a certain way for Mo Torre to then become a Norwich player at the back end of the window. And I'm with you. I think what excites me about Torre is not necessarily what he's doing now, but I think what he could be. I still don't think he is a really polished, refined finisher. I mean, you've mapped out his goals there, and he's you know, you've got to get in those. And actually, when I've spoken to him, the most pleasing elements around all of that is not the fact that he's scoring hat tricks or even that he's scoring goals. It's the type of goals that he's scoring. And he mentioned this yesterday, that those kind of scruffy striker poacher like goals that he's been getting. And if you break it down, the one against Blackburn was a tap in, wasn't it? The one in the cup came after Slimani juggled it three times. There was one against Oxford. It was a ball over the top and he beat the goalkeeper to it and had a tap in. The second one in that game was a brilliant move by Norwich down the left and across into the box that he got across his man and finished. The third one for me is probably at Oxford was the best finish that we've seen from him in terms of running on to a poor pass and arrowing it into the bottom corner. And he hasn't scored any goals or championship goals since that day, by the way. And then he's free yesterday. One, as you said, a rebound where he does so well to get in the position to get a free header and then to react the quickest. It's another tap in after brilliant work by Oscar Schwartau. And the third one hits him. So we're not talking about, you know, him being like Temupuki and some really aesthetic finishes. And the fact that probably he's scoring those type of goals is a sign there that Norwich have a player that is quick in terms of his pace, but also is quick in the mind and is quick to react to situations and scenarios. And as a striker in the box, you've got, particularly in this league, if you can be alert to things that drop or ricochet or deflect, you're going to do pretty well in terms of goals. So that's really exciting, coupled with, I think, what we spoke about, what he didn't do in the first half. If Norwich can get a little bit more out of him in that regard, and he's still so raw, I think, in terms of his general game. I don't think his first touch is always the most consistent, and I'd like to see him a little bit more in terms of the way he links the play, but you can't argue with his goal return at the moment. 16 shots he's had in the championship, and he scored 7 of them, which is pretty remarkable, it has to be said, for what he is doing. I agree with you about Oscar Schwartau as well. I think anyone who's listened, I wrote columns and all sorts on Oscar Schwartau, really, really like him and what he could be. And it's easy to forget how young he is. He's pretty close now to a century of games for Norwich. And it's already on top of what he's done at Bromby and played a lot of games there. And what impressed me about him yesterday, Paddy, was that he looked so tired in the first half. He looked kind of like he was struggling. And then 75th minute, he's just breezed past Sam Morsy as if he's not there. But then as well, for a 19-year-old, to have the awareness to be bearing down on goal and actually to spot that actually there's a player there where you can almost double the quality of chance and guarantee a goal. Really mature play and really good play. And like you say, beginning now to add those goals and assists, which I think is really exciting for him as it moves forward. And that's the thing, isn't it? It feels like there's lots of pieces there for Norwich to kind of lead off from what we've discussed from that creativity discussion. It's now about trying to slot them all together. And it's quite an exciting prospect to have Toure fit and available, to have Mukama fit and available, to maybe have another striker, Matthias Kriskor, and we don't know what the situation will be with him in the summer. That feels like quite a good place for Norwich to go into next season, because we know success in the championship, for all of the talk of Pukki in 18-19, you had Jordan Rhodes, who supplemented him with some big goals at big times. Even Jordan Hugill played that role. You need a real group of strikers if you want to go back to the Lambert season. It was Holt predominantly, but Jackson carried a lot of the load. They had Aaron Wilbraham as well. They had others. You need a real kind of core of strikers that are able to chip in with goals. It can't all be reliant on one guy. So the fact that we're talking about multiple Norwich City strikers, again, as we begin to look forward now, which feels like so much of where the Norwich City discourse is at the moment, is hugely positive.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right to flag. I mean, yeah, okay, you know, Pukki rightly got the plaudits because he scored multiples of goals in those two title winning seasons, but do not underestimate, you know, when required. I remember the odd game where Hugo had to come in. Was it Bristol City? And he scored twice on our road, and that was a big win. And obviously Jordan Rhodes chipped in, and he was just originally he was at the start of that season, of course, he was seen as the signing to be the attacking spearhead. So it just shows, you know, what feels set now isn't necessarily how it could develop over time. But what those two seasons of title winning success did prove is that you cannot solely be reliant on as good a striker, but no less one source of goals. And zoom out from that, Clement has often said, he said it around, you know, the Sargent thing when he first got in the building before the Toronto thing blew up. We cannot be reliant on one player to score goals. We need goals from all areas. And for him, that was midfield. That was defensively. Look at Jose Cordoba scoring yesterday. Pelle Mattsson doing what he's done. Kenny McLean has chipped in of late. You know, you will need, goals-wise, it to come from all across the team. Set pieces, they have to be better. And they've acknowledged that now in the last few days. Ryan Gary said after the game, that was a focus for them going into the Bristol game, an attacking set-piece threat where they can score goals. And, there's no doubt that level of competition, if you're talking purely back on the strikers, between McCarm, between Toure, between Chris Gordon, if he's still here, between possibly another addition of a more seasoned nature, that internal level of competition is going to drive up the standards. And the challenge now for Clement is, if it feels like he's getting that in certain areas of the team, I think there's clearly other areas of the team and the squad that isn't the case, and that the bed sheet is getting pulled a little bit of, in a direction where it's exposing one or two areas of the team, areas of the squad more broadly, where they don't have those interchangeable elements, and you feel the quality is of still of the same level. And that is the challenge now for Clement and all the recruitment types to go into the market and supplement those areas. But there's no doubt, as you said, you reeled off all those names, you know, the Schwartaus, Mahoma now, Slimani, what he's done with him. You know, Papa Diallo for me could be a big player when he's dropped back into the mix, and if he gets him firmly the other side of his fitness issue.
Can I mention another name which might raise eyebrows? Mate Jurasek.
Well, I was gonna throw him in, but then, you know, the jury is remaining out on him because
Clement likes him.
He does, clearly. But in what role? Where does he see him? Where do you think he sees him?
I think it would have to be on the right, wouldn't it?
The right of the three.
Hmm.
Yeah. See, I'm not sure he's dynamic enough for that role. But then, particularly what we talked about earlier about, you know, the transitional element or the approach that he wants away from home, that is for me a Schwartau type player in that right hand side. I don't see Jurasek running away from a fullback in quite such fashion. There's no doubt he's technically a very good player. For me, it's more inside, it's pockets coming in. But again, the debate we've had about, they'll need to be far more nuanced. They'll need to be different types of profiles. Yes, maybe in that setting you have your flyers to put that label on them, but, or your powerful runners, but you also need the guile and the technical ability to maybe, when the game dictates, the opportunities are inside the pitch, in those inside channels, then you have players like Jurasek who can come inside and use that ability they have on the ball to unlock something. But yeah, there's no doubt he likes him, but... for me, until we can get him in a state of physical robustness, then he's just not a viable option, is he? And I think that is the challenge now. And you can see the Paul Ford appointment is the primary example of that. But even this post-season, pre-season block of fitness that he wants to put that squad through, all of that for me is very much designed for across the board, but equally individuals like Jurasek, maybe Diallo as well, to get them into a state where you don't look at him and then the question mark comes about, but can he last the pace? Can he withstand 3-game-week cycles, the training blocks that go with that? At the moment, unfortunately, the answer is he can't, because the body of game time he's been available for over these past 12 months since he came through the door, a little bit longer now, would lead you to think that still remains very much a question. But yeah, there's no doubt he does like him. Because he's talked about him, he was aware of him before. So almost a player who maybe at previous clubs they would have looked at scouting-wise, recruitment-wise. So if you like the player, then, you know, that's a good starting point. But equally, you know, I for me, moving forward, to say that Mate Jurasek would be a frontline option, I think there's quite a distance to travel in that journey.
Yep, agreed. Big pre-season ahead for him. Anyone watching the podcast, behind Paddy is a nice screen. We started with a lovely picture of Mo Torre there, and I think you've ended up with a Cov one there, Pad, which is maybe fitting for the weekend that it's been.
You know what it is, Connor? I tell you, I'm being very distracted here. I shouldn't say I am, but I'm actually trying to follow the end of the Ipswich game as we're recording.
Finished 2-2, yeah.
Yeah, well, my ire is drawn by the headline here on the Sky app is controversial late penalty brings Ipswich level.
Yeah, wasn't a penalty.
It wasn't a penalty. Lord, you know, they're so wronged by the officials, aren't they, Ipswich, to go back to 2 or 3 weeks when Leif Davis is getting retrospectively banned. The world's against them, all these officials. Anyway, that's a different podcast. So anyway, controversial late penalty. So 2-2, still probably not a great result in the bigger picture. It gives Southampton more encouragement.
Yeah, it does. I was just going to draw up the championship table while you were speaking there, but that definitely does tighten things at the top of the table now. It does. Ipswich joint level on points with Millwall, that game in hand against Southampton, who are 1 point behind. And yeah, it's quite the queue of clubs now. You've got Ipswich on 76, Millwall on 76, Southampton fourth with 75, Middlesbrough fifth with 73. So you'd have to say with 2 games to go, they're not fully out of it either yet, but your boys Coventry obviously have done the job. Now it's all about the title for them. Moving forward for Norwich, Pad, we will because I think people will generally be interested in your thoughts on Coventry. So I'll get you on them towards the end for the people that have hung on to hear them. So if you don't want to hear that, you can hear the Norwich bit and then depart after that. But I think people genuinely are interested. There was a lot of nice comments on the live blog anyway. But Norwich are going to close, obviously, their championship campaign at Carrow Road this week. Doubleheader derby at home on Tuesday. That's going to be a really interesting game now because Derby are absolutely in that playoff conversation, as we discussed. Norwich technically aren't out of it. What is it, 8 points behind Hull with three to play. And they've got to also play Derby and Hull in that run. So not mathematically impossible, but yeah, I think we're both agreed and have been agreed since the start of maybe the playoff discussions that it would be beyond them. But yeah, really interesting race now. Eighth Derby with 66, seventh Wrexham with 67, and sixth Hull with 69. And as we mentioned, two of Norwich's final three games against Derby and Hull. So there is a possibility, even if it's not them, Paddy, that Norwich can have a real say on how the playoff picture shakes up. Not that that's going to be a huge distraction, I think, for Philippe Clement. Every time you kind of put those ones to him, he shakes them off to an extent. But that's an interesting subplot to this because I think what it does give is Norwich City some real challenge. We speak about the final four games, now the final three games, what they have to play for, what the motivation is. Maybe the motivation is the fact that they're going to be playing sides who have a lot of motivation. And as challenges, as tests of where this Norwich team are, that feels like a really good one. I mean, it's only Swansea now, effectively, at Carrow Road next Saturday, their final home game, where, and we'll come on to kind of player of the season and stuff, because we'll obviously crown ours in a moment or two. But the fact they are playing teams that have stuff on the line, I think, makes these games all the more kind of tantalising, doesn't it, from an Norwich perspective, as we begin to do what we've done so much in this podcast, to look to next season as to maybe which individuals, what maybe facets of Norwich City's overall game need to be improved heading into that campaign next year.
Yeah, I mean, I've quite liked Ryan Gary's framing of it yesterday when he said, in terms of what is there left to play for, he said to catch the teams above them, starting with, obviously, you know, Derby, who they play next, who are above them, not in terms of overtaking them off the base of, you know, potentially beating them, but closing that gap. And that I like that mindset because that means they're going to be driven and they're going to be, you know, rather than framing it in terms of any kind of backdoor sneaking into playoffs, it's just, okay, that's the next challenge. Can we go from ninth to eighth? Can we go from eighth to seventh? And, you know, I certainly said eighth. Did you say eighth, Connor? We did a little bit of a predictions crystal ball gazing about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and that is within reach now. And that would be bittersweet. Say they finish eighth and they're like 4 points off the playoffs. You would just, well, I mean, you'd obviously go back to that calamitous period under Manning, but equally, you'd probably look at some of the points under Clement. You know, the 2 points that went at Preston just before Christmas, that stoppage time.
You know, the scene I keep playing in back in my head is a Manqua Forson through on goal at Bramall Lane.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. But it was the other game at stoppage when they were leading in stoppage time recently, and they got pegged back.
Well, there was Oxford, wasn't there, one of the first ones?
Another one, more
Portsmouth.
Portsmouth. So if they fall 4 or 5 points short, and you think back to those three games, but you know, ifs, buts, and maybes. But no. So I like. Bring it right back down to the most base level you've got, which is next game, Carrow Road. It's Derby. Derby are above you in the table by position. Close the gap to them. And it will be a good test. Derby were at Coventry 2 or 3 weeks ago, and Coventry won in the end, but it was a very, very difficult assignment. 3-2, I think they won in the end, but they were trailing at one point. And you looked at some of the players Derby have got, particularly in forward areas, you know, very powerful players. I think Adjiman's got injured now, hasn't he? But they've got Carlton Morris there. They've got Britt and Diaz, who knows his way around the championship. John Eustace has given that kind of that steely streetwise edge. So I think that's another good exercise at Carrow Road. And the fact it's at Carrow Road, these next two, off the back of everything we discussed earlier in the podcast about maybe deconstructing the challenge they'll face, because I'm pretty sure Derby will be equally resolute defensively and out of possession, and maybe quite happy for Norwich to have more of the ball and more territory. But can they break them down? You know, as they failed to do against Ipswich, they failed to do on more than one occasion at Carrow Road and the Clement. So, yeah, I like the cut of that game, and also Hull away, because you know if they're where they are now, then they probably are going to need something to keep those at bay on the final weekend, and that's going to be a very, certainly from the Hull perspective, quite a fraught occasion, a lot of nerves, a lot of tension, and I think that's the type of game and environment Clermont will love to step into and spoil the party maybe in terms of the Hull situation. But so going from a position maybe on the morning of yesterday feeling, well, there's a lot of dead rubbers here. Now with the other side of it, with a win in the manner they did win down at Ashton Gate, and now these two, certainly two of the final three against teams with real live chances in the top six, that feels, yeah, a little bit more of a competitive edge to these remaining three fixtures. And I think that's good, because that'll bring the best out of this group of players, I'm sure. And they certainly won't want to come off the park against the Derby or a Hull and feel that they're falling the wrong side of it, because then that, you know, that just plants a little seed in terms of, you know, well, how far away are they now, and what sort of gap do they need to bridge? You know, the reality is, for me, it feels like lost to Borough, lost to Ipswich, lost to Southampton. That's the divide now. It's, I think Norwich are as good as this clump of clubs who are fourth downwards for me. But the ones who have gone, and okay, yes, they beat Carver and they also beat Millwall, so you could counter that argument. But I still do think they're a little bit short against the teams who have been in and around the top two all season. And that, you know, is now the challenge for Clermont from this period to the start of the new season, is equipping this group, be it improving what he's got now or adding to it, to turn them from where they are now, which for me is very much capable of contending for the top six, to raising that bar a little bit higher. And can they target the top two? And we know that's a challenge for obvious reasons. You know, the clubs will come down, particularly one certain club maybe from North London with limitless almost financial resources to go big in the Championship. But nevertheless, Coventry have proven it is possible. And so why not dream big, as I put in the pointers yesterday, you know. But it would be good over the course of the remaining three games just to provide more, you know, more evidence for those who believe that under Clermont, yeah, there's no doubt this is building towards a real full-on concerted assault on promotion next season.
Yeah, and hopefully they can send those home fans off with real enthusiasm heading into the summer as well, with a really decent points haul from those two games. That Tuesday night game feels probably the more exciting of the two. Swansea in a similar boat to Norwich and probably Bristol City, in that not huge amounts left to play for, but I think under Vitor Matos has done maybe not quite to as such grand a scale as Philippe Clermont, but Swansea were kind of in the lower depths of the Championship, and he's pushed them up the table and done pretty well there. And Vipotnik in particular, as we saw in the first game, a very talented player. So still kind of threats and issues that they're going to have to deal with in that game at home as well. So yeah, that's going to be a really interesting end to their home campaign, which, as we said, is although skewed slightly by that really poor start under Liam Manning, where they failed to win any of their, well, lost all of their opening seven games, most defeats in about 70 years, which when you contrast that with what they've done away from home, just all adds up to what has been a very odd, slightly surreal season in terms of it being as low as it was to maybe, it's not quite as high as you can get, but certainly significantly higher now in such a short period of time. It's been, yeah, pretty frantic, but we'll have a lot of time to assess and debate that. It is this week where we will, or we expect to learn, Norwich City's player of the season, young player of the season as well. Paddy, correct me, I haven't voted, so I don't know if you've voted. If I was to give you a vote for, let's start with young player of the season first, and then we'll build up. Who would your vote go for that? And I'm always intrigued to young player of the season as to what the cutoff is. I think there's lots of contenders though. Who would you give your vote to for that award?
I would probably go down the Kellen Fisher route, I think. Just and likewise with my choice for the player of the season, over the body of that, you know, campaign, good and bad, because in the bad periods you see which players can step forward and handle that, you know. When it was bad, it was pretty toxic, as we all can remember. And you know, you could look at McConville in a period of the season. Yes, very good, very consistent. Really took a step forward. We've talked about already Schwartau, and you know, you could argue he has been consistent throughout. But I still think there's been periods, maybe injury interludes, where he hasn't quite been at the same level. But So honourable mentions to those two. But for me, yeah, I think Fisher, because he's been there from game one to the end, you know, that durability, the versatility, the flexibility, you know, how many games has he stacked up now at left back as much as his preferred position? You know, he's in that England under 21 setup for a reason. We saw firsthand, you know, the quality of player they can call on recently at Carrow Road. He is deemed to be in that bracket. That's a very exclusive club to break into, you know, the Young Lions setup, given the ample talent you've got from Premier League academies downwards. So, and there's elements of his game I feel that he's added or he's developed this season. You know, it feels like he feels so comfortable now, and his personality is coming through on the pitch. He's taking a little bit more responsibility. And yes, of course, not the finished article, but no young player is going to be. But, you know, every time you see him, you just think, like a lot of these young players, the ceiling there is so high. And, you know, there's reason why he has been linked with clubs in the Premier League. And let's hope this summer isn't, too many scenarios around him. But if there was that interest, I wouldn't be surprised, because, again, that's a reflection of, you know, given his age and his backstory and where he came from, he does look a cut above, or potentially a cut above, Championship football for me. So I think, yeah, over the entirety, young player-wise, Kellen Fisher for me. What about you, Colin?
Yeah, so to make his 100th Norwich City appearance on Tuesday night, providing he starts. That was his 99th on Saturday. And to do that at such a young age, I think still 21, is pretty incredible. Not quite Max Aaron's levels. I think he's still the youngest player to ever do it. I think he was 20 when he hit 100 for Norwich. But yeah, to have done that at such a young age is a testament as well, and particularly his rise. I probably wouldn't go for him. I think he'd be a very, very close second, but I think I'd probably lean more towards Rory McConville in terms of impact and in terms of what was until that run recently. I think it was from the second game that Clement had in charge against Oxford to that Leeds United game after that. He was ever present in terms of importance and performances. I thought he was exceptionally good and what he's offered Norwich City in that period. They've kept, you know, more clean sheets, being defensively robust, really nice partnership with Jose Cordoba. I think it's a really nice story as well. There's a guy there who really, before Clement came in, felt like he was kind of third, fourth choice centre-back. Now feels like he's probably just behind Jose Cordoba for me as probably their second best. And I think, really excited. Hopefully he can get that knee issue sorted out over the summer, because I think that partnership looks really encouraging. So, yeah, take all your points on Fisher. And I think to be honest, you could, you know, almost draw their names out of a hat, and I think either of them would be really worthy winners. But yeah, for me, I think I'd lean towards Rory McConville just in terms of impact and some of those performance levels. But yeah, I think if Kellen Fisher is there next Saturday with that trophy again, that would be a second successive year, I think, as well. It would be very, very well deserved. So I think it is probably a race between those two. But yeah, honourable mentions to Oscar Schwartau, obviously Jovan Mikama as well, we'd have to put in that bracket. I just think probably for this one, and probably the main trophy, probably that injury just prevented him really from having enough of a run to really stake a claim for it. And to be honest, Paddy, unless you're going to say something that I'm not expecting, it feels to me like, certainly for that Player of the Year trophy, it feels like there's probably a pretty outright winner. Feels like one of those years. And it feels like it's probably not close. So you go ahead with yours, and hopefully you're saying who I expect.
I selected the first one, so it's only right that you get the choice of the Player of the Year. But I think I'm probably going to concur with you anyway.
Got to be Kenny, hasn't it? I think.
Yeah.
Just in terms of what he's done this season, obviously big picture stuff, 300 games, but I think this has been one of his best seasons as an Norwich player in terms of his role on the pitch, the responsibility that he's taken, the leadership that he's shown, not just in the good moments under Philippe Clement, but before that under Liam Manning as well. I think he is, for me, still Norwich City's best midfielder, for all kind of the praise around Pelle Mattsson, who's very, very good and has so much potential. if you look at consistency, I think Kenny McLean has done it consistently. The fact he's available every week, the kind of service and the, you know, playing through the pain barrier as he's done so often at the football club, some of the passing, some of the positional stuff, the leadership. I think he is the embodiment of probably everything that if you're a Norwich City fan, you want to see on the football pitch in yellow and green every week. And obviously Norwich fans have been really fortunate that he's done that over 300 times now for this football club. So yeah, for the second time and for all of those reasons, I think Kenny McLean would be, in my head at least, a pretty clear winner. Paddy, anything to add?
No, just to reinforce. Yeah, I mean, two things really. I do think some of that football he's played recently is the best that he has produced in a Norwich shirt. And I think that, wrote about it at the time, you get to a point in your career where, and he actually referenced it now, I think about it, when Adam spoke to him about that deployment on the right-hand side at Millwall recently, that he said, well, look, I know the game now. I understand the game. I feel comfortable in that position. And it does. It feels like he's playing like a player who's reached that, you know, that plateau where you've got all that, you've amassed all that experience. Physically, he clearly feels in a good place, and that's not always been the case in previous seasons. So his body, you know, is allowing him to go out and express, you know, what he can do. And he just understands his game, but he understands what is required in the Championship as well. So, and then the other thing, and you touched on it already, but you do go back to that rather dark period under Liam Manning in terms of results and feeling around the club. He was the only one who got anywhere near a level of consistency. The amount of games he would, and it probably was games where Norwich were getting beat, but he would be head and shoulders the best Norwich player on the pitch. It wasn't one game, it wasn't one or two games. It was pretty much that whole period. You know, his performance levels, as opposed to some of his other teammates, didn't just fall off that cliff and you know, it wasn't enough of itself. But even in a really difficult period, he stepped forward. He took that responsibility. He was trying to lead by example, and turn around the fortunes of the club. So, yeah, for all the reasons you've stated and I've reinforced there, I would find it hard to look beyond the mayor, yeah.
Yeah, proper Norwich legend now, isn't he, in terms of what he's achieved with the club. And yeah, hopefully now he's definitely going to be here next season, barring, I don't know, something. He'll probably get linked with Rangers again in the summer inevitably. But yeah, it looks like he's going to be here in an important part of it next season. Hopefully it will be a really nice way. I'm not going to send him off, but, you know, in terms of getting another promotion to what is a really extensive list of achievements at this football club. Right then, Paddy, finally, let's give you 2 minutes or so to talk about this week. And what it's been like for you. Obviously, your team Coventry getting promoted. I was sat next to you as it happened, which is quite something. I'll speak for you. It was pretty understated in terms of celebrations. But in terms of a weekend, obviously Coventry securing promotion, Leicester looking close to going down the drop door, Norwich City winning away at Bristol City. That's pretty good as far as you're concerned, isn't it?
Yeah. As long as I have a nice Sunday lunch waiting for me to finish recording, I'll be delighted, Connor. But we don't have time to eat, as you well know. And so, I'm looking out over out of our office window here, and the sun is shining in the fine city. So yeah, life feels good at the minute. Certainly on the footballing front. And it's we talked about it on the Instagram on Saturday morning. I just think it's setting aside my obvious allegiance, but for Coventry to do what they've done, defying, you know, that lack of parachute payments, that's not even then rolling in the backstory about how far they fell and you know, homeless and rudderless and at odds with the ownership group who were in charge through those 7 or 8 years. And then Mark Robbins was almost the catalyst, and then Frank Lampard has built on it. But it does show, and it should give hope to any set of fans, you know, what Coventry have done, what Lincoln have done at the step below. If you get that clear alignment, you get good people in positions of power, and they're all on the same page. And there's a great relationship clearly between Lampard and Doug King, you know, Norwich supporter in his youth from Lowestoft area. But it's just great for the people. You know, both my sisters are season ticket holders still. I've got a football mad nephew. He's a season ticket holder, and now they'll get to see Liverpool, Arsenal. Maybe not Tottenham, but Chelsea, Man City, you know, some of the best players in the world pitching up at Coventry. And going back to my youth, you know, when, show my age, but when Coventry were last in the First Division, it was then, and then the Premier League, you know, to see those players up close, you know, is a thrill. And hopefully, you know, they can have a good go at staying there. You know, whether they can do it as Sunderland, it remains to be seen. But I certainly feel that they will have a good go and they'll try and do it their way. And, you know, as I say, it should be an inspiration now for bringing it right round to Norwich that next season that could be them. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that, you know, the clubs who are coming down are potentially going to have a lot of work ahead to sort of, you know, balance themselves out. You see the fate that's befell Leicester. Southampton have had to come from a very long way to start their run. You know, I don't think it's a given now that, you know, clubs come out of the Premier League and they will be the ones who will go straight back. I think that the playing field is far more level. And if a club like Coventry with a group of players who, I don't think, bar one or two, have had any Premier League experience, yet they've been good enough to come together under a head coach who is clearly very innovative and able to extract the maximum from the resource he had available. Well, Clement has shown he could do that. And then above them, you know, and it feels maybe that's hopefully where we are now with Attanasio and Norfolk Holdings. And Clement himself has spoken about that, that there is that alignment, there is that trust. That's what brought him to the club when he looked at Norwich and thought, well, no, that's not going to be a level I want to go back in. But they sold him that vision. And that's why this summer will be very interesting. What does that look like in terms of player recruitment? But you have to think that, you know, come the first day of next season, Norwich are more than capable of doing what Coventry have done. And if they do, then the scenes I'm seeing, you know, back home now in the last few days, and hopefully they'll go on and lift the title and there'll be a nice trophy parade. It'd be great to, you know, roll it on 12 months and we're all gathered outside City Hall, that balcony, and, you know, throngs of people looking up at that gleaming championship trophy, and off the back of that then a return to the Premier League. What exciting 12 months we'd have ahead if they could do that. So let's hope that's the case, Connor.
Yeah, yes, please, Philippe, if you're watching, if you can make that happen, that'd be fantastic. I'm sure he's not. He's got better things to be doing. Absolutely. But there we go. That gives certainly something for aspirational championship sides like Norwich to try and replicate next season, and hopefully they can do just that. Just a word at the end of the pod. Tickets for our live podcast, May the 3rd at the Yard in Norwich City Centre, still available. £6 for non-subscribers. If you're a subscriber as well, there's a discount code that you'll be able to find in our daily newsletter. That means that you get a little bit off that to come and join us. We're really looking forward. Tickets selling fast, so make sure you go quickly. We'll leave the link down below, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening as well. We'd really love to see you there. We need, obviously, it would be nice to have a room full of people to speak to do this nonsense to as well. And that is the day after the final day of the season, so we can have a really good chew of the fat about what a weird campaign it has been for Norwich City. But this was a very good weekend for the Canaries. A hat-trick for Touré again, an away win for Norwich again, and really onto the home straight now. Thank you very much for watching. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Casino. Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.